Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Einstein & Gogo. I'm Dr. Shane. Thank you so much for tuning in to Triple R and especially tuning in to us for an hour of science. In the studio with me is my old buddy Chris KP. Good morning, sir.
Hello there. How are you this Sunday?
Is your microphone even working?
I can make noise.
It is not working. Can I get you to sit over there for me?
Okay, hang on.
It's okay if you do it without him.
As much as I love to mute you. Good morning, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
That's so much better. And Dr. Susie, good morning.
If you do the show without him, it's fine.
I know.
It's just background noise, really.
I feel nothing different. I think if you turn me down to sort of 15%, I could just be the voice in your heads.
This is so odd now. He's on the other side of me. I'm not used to this.
What people don't realise is that this studio is about 60 metres wide. I had to run all that distance. Yeah. Get here.
Yeah, you're a small person.
But now I have to turn my head the other way, and I can't handle it.
Oh, I hear you. You're the disconcertment of having him to my right and not to my left.
It's just what happens.
In 30 years, I don't think he's ever been to my right.
What is this year doing to us?
It just feels weird.
It feels wrong.
Yeah, I agree. I'm staring into the middle distance between the both of you and looking at nothing in particular.
Yeah, whereas normally you'd like to look at your own reflection in the mirror.
Well, you've seen it, right?
You know. Yeah, it's pretty special. Well, folks, we're gonna do some news since we seem incapable of getting Chris KP's microphone to work. What do you got, Chris?
I have two stories, if I can put it that way. I stumbled upon a meta study led by a team at the University of China who were looking at dementia. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, they found that purely and simply at a correlation level, but they found that potentially up to 1 in 3 cases of dementia could be traced or at least connected to completely non-brain-related diseases.
Right.
Mm. You know,
like what are we talking?
Like type 2 diabetes, like gum disease,
yeah,
like things that are... You know, we don't know the connection. Maybe there's no connection. Maybe there's a connection that's 4 or 5 steps removed, but they're going, yeah, there's a lot of this. And there was, I think they identified 14 diseases that they could connect with some level of credible correlation. Yeah, but nothing to do with the brain in any direct sense at all. So that's interesting. It's a bit disturbing, but it's also interesting because if you think, well, if any of these were shown to have some sort of mechanism, then, well, that's what a great mechanism. You detect that and you've got yourself ahead of the game a bit. So as it happens, in a completely unrelated study by an entirely other team, they've developed basically a little tiny patch that you can stick in your mouth, sticks to your gums.
Mm.
It's in layers. So you've got the layer that sticks. You've got the layer that that filters. So essentially it's a fine graphene maxine mesh that filters out and filters in particles. And it can detect inflammation particles or particles, molecules associated with inflammation before you can tell you've actually got an inflamed gum.
Right. Wow.
How nifty is that? Now, at this point, it's
how,
all just
how big a patch are we talking here? Just so
just your entire upper set. No, I don't know. this is the thing. It's early. So at this point, they've only done it in animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very small. And it's basically to prove that they can detect tiny, tiny concentrations of these molecules. That's all it is. And that they can make the thing stick.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it. The
in the gum, that's the challenge.
Exactly, because it's A, it's wet.
Yeah.
B, it moves. And C, you're shoving stuff in and out of it.
All the time.
Yeah. It's stuff moving around. And they've done that. So they reckon they've got those two bits right. So it stays there and it functions, and on a chemical level, it works. If they can then, what's not clear from the article I was reading is, well, what do you do with that? Does it beam out a message? Do you have to look at a colour change? Do you pull it off after 2 weeks?
Spit it out.
Yeah, what do
I'm
you
just
do?
Seeing the Weigh Star Trek, you know, with the hovering.
Exactly. Maybe that'd be great. Just pass through a thing and it tells you. I don't know. But let's assume that thing's either fixable or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Then, again, this is one of those really easy things before. And a lot of people get gum disease.
Mm-hmm.
A hell of a lot of people do.
And usually, that's causing problems to the brain.
Yep.
Exactly. And in itself, it's usually treatable and that's fine. But if it's got some other broader connection, you know, decades down the track for you, it'd be really nice to know about that.
Yeah.
So there you go. Two little stories that jumped out at me in the early hours of a morning.
Of the morning. Very nice.
This morning. Mm-hmm. Also shows you the importance of dental hygiene and generally getting it checked out, which I feel like
100%.
In Australia with the money you pay is not a given.
Yeah,
no,
I say this very well knowing that this is all free in Germany, and I very much miss that every time I have to pay for it.
it would be good, wouldn't it?
I know. Do something about it out there.
In case Medicare's listening, which we know they
please,
are.
Please.
We know they are.
Well, I am switching topics here completely. I want to talk about Kanzi. Kanzi is, or was, I have to say, sadly, a language-trained bonobo. Yes. I love a good bonobo study.
Me too.
These are super interesting apes. They're not monkeys. They're mm-hmm. you know, counting to the groups of apes. But this one, he was living in the U.S., was trained by recognizing languages and I think over 300 signs. So they could do a lot of experiments with him without, you know, harming an animal per se. And this one is a particularly interesting one. They actually did this last year before he sadly passed away at the age of 44, which is incredible. Mm. It's like, you know, 44-year-old ape.
Is that long for one of
that
them?
It's a long time. They're like not that big an animal.
These days I compare everything to old sharks.
Yeah,
that's unfair. That is an unreasonable bar.
They're like hundreds of years old. Oh, yeah, I'm like,
I mean, let's just go all the way to turtle, you know? Yeah. And you're just like, yeah. Whatever.
So I'm always curious when I hear about an animal where I don't know their age.
That is a decently old age.
A decent old age.
Yeah, so that's in captivity anyway. They live longer than
cool
in the wild.
They're cool if you ask them to. They're not offended if you ask how old they are.
I know, right? They just tell you.
That's how they found out.
Maybe one of the 300 signs that he had, though, was not piss off. How dare you?
I know. Well, this one had supposedly a really great life because they did a study with him to show if apes of any kind, in this case bonobos, could have imagination. And they tested it by something that comes into humans very early. So we developed this up from, I think, 12 months between the age of 12 months and 3 years as children by playing imaginary tea parties. So if anyone out there has, you know, kids or nieces and nephews, it's what you do all the time. And they come up with the wildest things. I'm so amazed. It's incredible what goes on in their brain and what they tell you what's happening right now. And you're like, okay, I'm in this imaginary world now. Yeah. And I'm a dragon. And so they've sat him down and they had empty glasses in an empty jug and did the, you know, imaginary pouring of cups of juice. And then they took one of the imaginary full juice glasses and poured it back into the, you know, empty pitcher. And they asked him which one of them is the full one and which one is the empty one because he understood language. And he got that right 68% of the time. Which is, like, that sounds like a low number, but that is about the same as probably a child would get, you know, between the ages of 12 months and 3 years. So that is incredible.
So what's interesting about that is, I suspect that part of the remaining 32% may not be getting it wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm imagining something else.
Yeah, and I mean, he's 43 years at that stage, right?
Yep.
He's also, like, he died a year later, so...
Maybe he had some dementia going.
Yeah, what was in the imaginary drink?
Yeah, just...
I wonder, though, whether at times he was doing these tests just going, I don't think these humans know that there's nothing in the cup.
That is a very, very good question because they tested that too. So they tested his theory between having real juice in a glass and the imaginary poured one and also grapes on a platter. So, you know, the imaginary grape picking and then with real grapes and imagine. And he picked the right, like the real ones every time so he can distinguish between this stuff's real and this is just in your head. Sure. But I play along with the in your head thing because clearly you enjoy this. So I just go along with it.
I mean, to be fair, if they had an Australian researcher in the team, the first thing we would test is whether that particular species was able to take the piss out of another species.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because that's what we do.
Yeah. I'm just imagining it's like, if that's what you're into, I'm here for it. I mean, you know? I'll just play along.
I would be less interested in imagination because I just assume they can do that. I think for me, that's a baseline assumption. I'd be more interested... Can they take the piss out of us?
Well, I guess they could.
Like, that would be fun.
But that's next level, isn't it? It's genuinely next level. It's one thing to imagine, but it's something else to imagine at someone else's expense.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
exactly.
We might know sometime. But saying that, you know, we assume that they have imagination, but this is like an actual scientific study proving they have.
Well,
and that's incredible.
Imagine it's important in evolution, too.
Yes,
like, it's a really important part of us understanding the environment around us.
This begs the question now, you know, this animal, you know, great ape, was... one of the few ones that got, I guess, trained by humans. You know, he was trained in language and sign recognition. So he spent a good amount of his lifetime in captivity, if you want to say it that way. And, you know, with humans being trained on all these things. So he was enabled to communicate that way. Obviously, in the wild, there's not someone who's going in the, you know, bonobo school and says, this is a grape and this is an empty glass of juice. Yep. So, you know, what is this translatable into the wild? We don't know. But it is a very good question about evolution. You know, what happens if we come together as a community and this is the way we interact with each other? Is this what's happening every time?
Yep. just once again proves that we don't know as much as we
thought.
Like, there was a story over the summer, and we missed it because we weren't on air, but about a cow using tools.
Oh, yes. Love it.
And I was laughing about this.
This is great, you know, because every time we hear one of these stories, it reminds us, hey, humans, you're not as smart as you thought.
And we're not that different from the great, the apes we are still around. Anyway.
Or the cows in many cases.
All right. Let me tell you something exciting, folks. I've been doing this thing lately where I've been trying to work out what is the biggest story of the week, and especially my field of, you know, astronomy. And
there's so many cool stuff this week. What have you chosen?
Well, the one I picked up was, you know, we have this, there's a big black hole at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius A, and it's very exciting. We don't know why, don't go near it, it's problematic. But we also know that near really strong gravitational fields, you get time dilation. So, in fact, the GPS system in your phone has to compensate for the fact that you're close to the Earth, but the satellite's giving you the data are further away. And so because we're closer to the gravitational center of where the Earth is, we actually there's a time shift. There is a problem you have to correct for. It's very minor, but over weeks, if you don't correct for it, you'll find yourself, you think you're at a high point, but you're actually at Chadston.
So that's a problem.
You're working it out pretty quickly.
But near a massive black hole, these effects, and for anyone who's seen the film Interstellar, can appreciate that these effects are very substantial. So it would be great if I could grab Chris's wristwatch, take it near that black hole and use it to work out, you know, some of those things around time and how that's changing. Well, you know, getting a wristwatch out there was going to take a while.
Also, don't go near a black hole.
What if instead researchers recently determined that there was a radio signal that they were picking up right near Sagittarius A from what they think is a millisecond speed pulsar? So this is an old dead star that's rotating and putting out pulses of light. And if you find one of these things are perfect clocks. Yeah. They're perfect. Yeah. But if you put it right near a very strong gravitational field that's moving around, all of a sudden you've got Chris's watch and you're moving it around and you've got a little experiment out there working for you, and it doesn't get much better than that. So they're still confirming it, but this could be really cool because it's like grabbing your own experiment and dumping it next to this black hole and being able to get the data from that location from a very, very rapidly oscillating object that gives us these spikes in electromagnetic radiation.
Do they know exactly which pulsar it is? Like, have they been studying that before? No.
So this is relatively new. And look, there are pulsars everywhere in the universe. And they're just everywhere. Not everywhere, but, you know, there's a lot of them. But, you know, this is an area of space that's pretty hot. There's a lot of stuff there, you know, because it's around the black hole. There's a lot of crap there. You know?
It attracts don't go near it.
but the idea that we might have this signal available there is really, really cool. So anyway, so there was that. And then the other thing that jumped out at me, and this was, I don't know if this was better or not, but there is a thing called the Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory at the South Pole down in Antarctica. And this is a buried detector that is used to detect neutrinos, which, you know, if you remember, neutrinos pass basically through everything. And every now and then, if you're really lucky, you can detect one. Why is that
cool?
Because
it hits something.
Yeah, well, it interacts with water that is in these detectors and gives off light. But the reason this is cool is because these things pass through everything, they're still in the form they were in when they were created, which might have been on the other side of the universe. So they're kind of pristine. So they're interesting, right? But they've just done this amazing upgrade, the biggest upgrade at this facility in the last 15 years. And they actually have to do it. They actually have to lower these things a couple of kilometers down into where this
dark
experiment
and
is.
And quiet.
Really cool. I mean, I don't know if they've seen the movie The Thing, but that's scary shit.
Yeah.
It's basically what's happening. Yeah.
But this is a massive upgrade to one of our coolest sort of cosmic telescopes that we don't hear about a lot, but it's down there in Antarctica, and it's doing some really cool stuff detecting these particles that normally just, you know, thousands of them pass through all the time, millions. They just don't interact. And when something doesn't interact, it's really hard to detect. So you need these super quiet, super isolated detectors.
How boring are we?
We're boring.
That is the first whisper going, nothing to see here, moving on.
Yeah, exactly. They go right through us. All right, folks, we're going to take a break for some station announcements. And when we come back, we'll be speaking to our first guest for today, believe it or not, about experimental particle physics. So,
great.
Some cool stuff
there.
I know. Yeah, that's what they do.
London-based space rock outfit Public Service Broadcasting return to Melbourne this May. Their first Australian tour in 8 years, their visually arresting shows turn historical narratives into rich soundscapes.
You're moving in a dream that deludes and debilitates.
Public Service Broadcasting play Northcote Theatre on Thursday the 7th of May. Tickets on sale now from handsometours.com. RRR sponsors.
there's no difference. I'm not seeing anything at all.
Dive into Sound System Subculture at Fed Square on Saturday, February 25th for the Afro-Caribbean Carnival. Presented by Fed Square and Stick Maribo Productions, it's a free day-to-night dance party featuring international headliners Sister Nancy and General Levy and local sound system legends New Flower Sound System, Yabai Hi-Fi and General Feelings. Only at Fed Square, RRR sponsors.
Coming up at Kindred Bandroom, The Gnomes with Stimpies and the Mundanes. Models, Ben Lee, Chain, Helen Ryder, Bill McDonald and David Chesworth, and Opelousas. Also in the calendar, a free Valentine's block party featuring Cool Out Sun, Horatio Luna, a.k.a. Zeb, Mother Funk, Mosey, Shio, and more. For tickets and more info, head to kindredbandroom.com.au. Triple R sponsors.
Experience the arts in full colour with The Rounds 2026 season, A Colourful Life, celebrating culture, community and creativity in every shade. See striking theatre, circus, music and more, including Chrissy Whelan-Brown, Rachel Beck and Nathan Cavalieri, plus Najanang Circus's award-winning Arterial, exploring First Nations connections, and Shake and Stir's Grimm, pushing the boundaries of fairy tales. Tickets on sale at theround.com.au. Triple R sponsors.
Yeah, welcome back, folks. You're listening to Einstein the Go-Go on 3RRR. In the studio with us now, we have Sai Pemaraju, who is a PhD student at the University of Melbourne working in particle physics. Sai, welcome to 3RRR.
Thanks so much, Shane. Thanks for having me here, and thanks everyone.
Yeah. It's great to have you in. Now, we were just talking about, I'm not sure these two knew I was talking about particle physics, but I was.
That's right.
I was talking about physics and particles. And when you put
I know those two things. Don't put them together.
No. They're all good. But you're working in the space of dark matter. We've had a few people on before talking about dark matter. But now, first of all, experimentalist or theoretical physicist?
I'm very much on the experimental side.
Okay.
Mostly on the computational aspect of it.
Yeah. Right. So working out what the experiments need to do.
Exactly. Okay.
And this is all down at the Stahl mine, the old mine down in Stahl that's been converted?
That's right, yeah. We've got... So the experiment that I'm working on is called Sabre South. It's meant to be located deep underground in the Stahl gold mine, about 240 kilometres west of here.
Yep.
We're at the bottom of an active gold mine. That's right.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And have you been down there in the mine?
I've been there once to do a live stream activity. For International Dark Matter Day last October. But most of my work is just sort of sitting in front of a computer and building models of this detector and sort of seeing how particles kind of interact with the detector.
Was it cool to go? I remember going to a mine once on a tour up in Bendigo, and I was like, I don't want to be a miner. It was loud, it was wet, it was dark. Similar experience?
Yeah, it's very similar. We arrive in Stahl and then we kind of get driven down to the mine. It's about a kilometre underground. So, it does get quite warm over there, quite hot, upwards of, I think, close to 40 or above 40 degrees, I think the temperature gets to.
Yeah.
But then you enter the lab and it's all air conditioned and, you know, you're all sort of laid back. Yeah.
Glory days, you got the coffee machines.
It's the dream of a physicist. I see what's going on here.
That's what we do. Okay, so now tell us about the experiment that you're doing the work for specifically.
That's right. So the experiment that we're working for, that I'm doing work on right now, is what we call the Sabre South experiment. And what it is it's an example, it's an example of what we call a direct detection experiment of dark matter. What that means is it's just fancy speak for we have a target material, which in our case is a sodium iodide crystal, and the crystal is attached to a pair of light detectors.
Okay.
And the mechanism is such that kind of you place your detector deep underground and then you sort of allow, you sort of wait and see if a dark matter particle sort of interacts with the crystal. If a dark matter particle interacts with the crystal, it sort of excites the atoms inside of it. And, you know, when we get excited, we yell, we scream, we shout, we do whatever whatever we do. But when atoms get excited, they give off light, and that light can be detected by our light detectors. So based on that, we can kind of infer kind of what properties this dark matter can have if it does indeed end up happening. Yeah, that's right.
And I remember when the LIGO, you know, the gravitational wave detector, was first switched on, and I always had this image that everyone was sitting around going, well, how long do we need to wait? And it was about a month for those guys, you know. It was really short. It was really short.
Yeah.
Are there any expectations in terms of the, you know, just what you know about the experiment and stuff with regards to how frequent it should be detecting dark matter, given what we know?
Okay, I can't recall the exact number off the top of my head, but we're looking at a few counts per day. So it's a very rare interaction of dark matter. Yep. You know, it's very rare, the way dark matter interacts with our crystals or with our detector. We expect it to be quite rare. But yeah, with about 2.5 or 3.
But we're not waiting years.
No, that's right. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it does interact,
yes.
Is it always the same?
We don't know.
Okay.
We presume it's the same. Yeah. Okay. So right now, I think if I were to describe it to you, it's kind of like, you know, dark matter is sort of passing right through us. You know, we assume it's kind of it kind of should interact the same way. But you know, we should be prepared in case it is it doesn't. But yeah, for the purposes of our experiment, we just assume that, you know, the dark matter interacts with the crystal, excites the atoms, and then sort of the mechanism happens in that way. Yeah.
Mm. And when you do the simulations and so forth of these experiments, I mean, what sort of changes does that involve for the experimental design itself? I mean, what sort of information do you get out when you do that modelling and stuff?
That's a fantastic question, actually. One of the things, for example, one of the things we can sort of figure out is how pure, how do we clean our crystals,
right.
You know, for example. And there are people at the ARC Centre of Excellence for Dark Matter that are working on this. How can we clean our crystals such that we can maximise our chances of detecting a potential signal? So those kinds of things are kind of what give us, you know, yeah, those kind of things give us an idea of, you know, how we can optimise our detectors to...
Interesting. Yeah. And with these crystals, are we talking about... I suppose I always had this image that there'd be like a 1,000 crystals lined out all over the floor somewhere with detectors everywhere. Is it one big one, or what are we talking about?
Yeah, so there's 7 crystals, and you know, the image you I try and tell people to think about is kind of a big lump of salt. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can take it with, you don't take it with a grain of salt, but yeah,
a big grain of salt.
It's a big crystal with made of sodium iodide. It's about 7 kilos, and there's 7 of them.
Right.
And we've sort of got them arranged in a certain way, such that we can wait for the dark matter particles to interact with our detector.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And the location, you know, being underground like that,
exactly.
Is that... What's the primary sort of noise issue that you're overcoming with, you know, doing the experiments there?
Yeah, so the purpose of having it underground is because you know, we get a lot of sort of constant sort of interaction with muons if we place things on the surface.
Okay.
So a muon is basically, if an electron sort of bulked up, it's an electron, slightly heavier version of it.
Okay.
Right. And if we place our detector on the surface, we will get a lot of muons, which can probably possibly obscure our dark matter signal if we were to detect one. But if we go down a kilometer underground, the amount of muons that hit the detector are much lower. So, you know, it seems like a logical choice.
Yeah. One of the questions I love to ask particle physicists is, what's the detection threshold for you guys to say we've done it? So, you know, in the Large Hadron Collider and so forth, yeah, it's millions, you know, like the number of actual detections of a particular particle before someone can come out and say, we've detected this.
Yep.
It's very large. You've got 7 of these crystals.
Yes.
Like, how many dark matter events would you have to be detecting before you say, hey, we think we've done it?
That's a great question. And honestly, I'm not 100% sure of the exact number. But in terms of, you know, getting the result, you know, looking for... conclusively saying that we are looking for the result that we want, we need about 2.5 to 3 years of data.
Yeah, right. So this is LIGO, the gravitational wave goes, one.
Yeah.
They're cheaters, aren't they?
But it's a good one.
I love it. One.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Like, this, I find these are fascinating aspects of science. We're talking about other sort of areas of research coming up, and you know, what the N has to be, how many accounts do you have to have, and like in particle physics, it's enormous,
exactly.
Right? In other areas, it can be one. Mm. You know, I mean, if you're asking me, you know, what happens when you jump off a building, Dr. Shane, I'm like, I'm not doing that experiment, because the answer is
you're only doing it once.
You're only doing it once, right? You get the answer. And in terms of like the control of these experiments.
Yeah.
I sort of, again, I have this image that this thing's kind of got a little hatch and it seals up, and then you're all sitting back there in Coonabarabran Brown or somewhere on computers just watching the data come in. Is it all remotely operated?
Ooh, I'd imagine so. We're still sort of undergoing construction, by the end of the year, I'll have a definitive answer for how things are working. But right now, yeah, things are quite quite busy. Things are moving around in the mine. We're in the process of getting our equipment down there, and hopefully towards the end of the year, I'll be able to answer that question.
And so you're partway through your PhD, right?
That's right. So I'm just in my second year.
You're in the second year. Holy shit, this is getting real year.
Where you're doing the one where you hopefully get results.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
No, the first year is, I always say this, the first year is like, oh, this is so exciting, I'm doing a PhD. Second year is, oh, shit, this is real. And then third year is, I think I'm going to make it.
Yeah. Or maybe I won't make it.
So that's cool. And what's the next big thing you're having to crack at in your PhD? Like, what's next on the agenda?
Oh, at the moment, just trying to crank out a solid simulation framework for SaberSouth.
Yep.
I also do some work for Hyper-K, which is an upcoming experiment based a little bit further away in Japan.
Right.
And what they do is they kind of probe neutrino flavor oscillations. So we have our standard model. There are certain particles in the standard model which undergo what we call mood swings. So they kind of change from one type to another. So neutrinos undergo these oscillations. And we want to understand that phenomenon better, because that ultimately gives us an idea of, that ultimately allows us to answer the question of why is there more matter than antimatter in the universe, right? Because why is there this asymmetry?
Yeah.
So we're hoping that, this will help us give an answer to that. But that experiment's a little bit further away in terms of we're hoping for it to come live in mid 2028. So it's still a way away. So Saber's kind of the main priority. We're trying to get a good simulation framework and sort of help with assembling the detector.
Yeah. It's super cool stuff. So I wish I was around doing my PhD at this time when there's so many of these detectors and stuff and telescopes coming online, and it's a wild time to be in particle physics and astrophysics in general.
Yeah.
So good luck with the ongoing work of the PhD, and thanks so much for chatting today.
Thanks so much for having me. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. Thanks.
Folks, we're going to take a break for some music, and when we come back, we'll be having our second guest in the studio. Yeah, welcome back, folks. That was Owaloo Dreamhouse with Realized. You're listening to Einstein and Gogo. We have our second guest in the studio now. Her name is Dr. Michaela Baresi. Michaela is she's at the School of Health and Biomedical Sciences at RMIT University. Michaela, welcome to Triple R.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you in. You work in the area which I have always found ridiculously fascinating, and Chris Gapier will give me a look for this, but you look at the way the brain folds.
Yes, yes.
And can you take us back to what happens when we're born? Because I'm not sure most people know that when we first start off, our brain's not folded, right?
Well, in humans, we're born folded.
Well, we're born folded.
Yeah, well, yeah. I do my research. We use ferrets in the lab. And in that particular animal, they're born smooth-brained.
Right.
And then they develop folds. We've also got, when we think about mice, they stay completely smooth their whole life. They don't need to develop folds. But in humans, folding sort of starts around about 10 weeks of gestation.
Okay.
And it goes through that second trimester. But, you know, we've got folds occurring and, you know, perfecting themselves well into adolescence. So, yeah.
It seems like a weird question, but, like, what is the purpose of the folding? Like, what's the advantage of the brain folding?
Yeah, folding is so interesting. You know, the brain folds because, we can fit more neurons. So neurons are the cells that are sending those electrical signals and chemical signals. We can fit more neurons into a more confined space. You know, we've got way more surface area. The brain can expand and, you know, it folds and we fit way more cells and neurons. And, you know, that helps us with intellect. Some people think that, you know, that might have contributed to humans being smarter.
Right.
So, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, evolutionary advantages. You know, we've got a lot of mammals that do fold, humans, ferrets, cats, dogs, dolphins.
Dolphins fold?
Yes.
Dolphins fold.
They have a folded brain.
Favorite animal? Yet again.
Smart.
Dolphins. Your favorite animal is a dolphin.
A dolphin, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah,
they're amazing.
Interesting.
And carnage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and in terms of, like, when you talk about these other animals, is there, like, and you've just said there that some people think there might be that correlation between intelligence and so forth. Is there a correlation between the degree of folding and the intelligence of the species?
It's so funny that you say that. So there's been some work in the space. We don't have a definitive answer yet where, you know, we thought there might be a correlation with the degree of folding and, you know, how big the brain gets and then how much it folds. And, you know, we have this index, it's called a gyrification index, where we sort of measure the contours of the outside of the cerebral cortex. We try and work out, you know, the degree of folding, but we haven't definitively found a connection between that because, you know, we've got even birds that fold. Birds can be so smart, you know, and they've got a folded brain and they're tiny. We've got dolphins who have a much larger brain.
Yep.
We've got humans. Elephants have a folded brain, much larger than humans, you know, but then we've got us who we have all of our, cognitive advantages, you know, problem solving, things like that. So, that one's not definitively answered yet.
Interesting.
Yeah.
In a given species, is the folding uniform? Like, is it the same rate or pattern in the same regions, or is it much more individual than that?
I love that question because it formed the basis of my doctoral thesis, and any opportunity to talk about my thesis, I'm going to take it.
But that's not going to be my doctoral thesis then.
You missed it. It's done.
So actually, the primary folds, those ones that I was telling you about that happen from about 10 gestational weeks, they are largely conserved between individuals. So the folds that form first, even some of the secondary folds, mine are the same as yours. They're developing in the same location. They're stereotypically mapped across the brain. This happens for us. It happens for ferrets. So they've got a sort of a more intermediary folding pattern. So it's a little bit less than humans. It's still conserved. So this is really, really useful for us because it helps us to predict. So we can use different tools to predict, like looking at differences in gene expression. So that was one of my studies, looking at the differences between genes that might form a fold versus forming a groove, because we know where they're going to form, which is awesome, right?
Nice.
And so is that the stuff you're working on now, like this, around the genes and so forth? Because it's always curious to me, like, what tells the brain, put a fold here? You know, what tells that, you know, like that, that to me is like fascinating because, like, as you say, we all have the same folds in the same locations, right, in our species.
Yeah.
So there is something in our genetic makeup that says you're going to put eyebrows here and you're going to put a fold here. And there is something there that...
Don't get them mixed up.
Don't get them mixed up. Well, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely, that is the focus of my research question. You know, we work towards it. Unfortunately, you know, we found so many regionally expressed genes.
Right.
You know, it's not a one-size-fits-all that, you know, this is the folding gene and when this is expressed here, we're going to grow a fold.
Right.
But we do know that when things change in different areas of the brain in terms of gene expression, in terms of the cell's behaviour, so we there's a process called proliferation. It's where the cells will expand the population. You know, if that doesn't happen, we're not going to get a fold because we don't have enough cells to fill that area.
Yep.
You know, we've got neuronal migration. That's where the cells need to move to fill out that cortex. If that doesn't happen, we're not going to get a fold, right?
Interesting. Yeah.
Speaking of gene coding about this, is this something that is relatively robust or is this something like, you know, we've seen nowadays that a lot of our genetic coding is very susceptible to the external influences we have, right? If it's going to be like trauma to the head or exposure to some kind of, I don't know, lead chemicals or whatever that's harmful for us or other things. Is this like, you would want this to be something that's relatively robust to outside influence, right? Because you wouldn't want to mess around with your brain folds. But is this something that, that gets influenced by our outside experiences or?
Yeah, folding is definitely, it is definitely something that can be influenced, especially during pregnancy. It's so susceptible to, you know, fetal alcohol exposure is one of those things that can really have a bad outcome for folding, intrauterine growth restrictions. That's another model that we have in our lab that we do. And so when the placenta is not providing enough nutrients to the baby, we get alterations to the way that the brain grows, of course. So, you know, and that's all going to affect the way that the cells are able to do what they're doing, cell death, you know, and then we don't get the brain forming like it should.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I think this idea of especially like something like a ferret where it starts off smooth for quite a while. Are you able to detect something that is switching on at the point that just says time to fold, or is it a sheer volume sort of problem where we go, okay, we're out of room here, we're going to have to start folding, or things are going to be problematic inside this forming skull?
Well, it's so funny that you bring that up, because that actually was one of the theories of cortical folding. So one of the, you know, people just thought, oh, well, I guess the brain ran out of room in the skull and it's just got to compress on itself and buckle by nature. But that
sounds like headache.
That's very punny. So, you know, and you think, well, that doesn't explain how the folds are always in the same place.
So that
doesn't help us, you know. And we have actually tried, you know, if we give the brain more space, will it just keep growing? It doesn't. It still folds
anyway.
It still folds. And so, you know, it's not just a necessity of running out of space. But so, you know, in the ferret at around 5 days old, that's when they start folding. It, you know, maybe there's something that switches on at 5 days. Maybe there's something that switches on 20 days earlier and it's already priming the cortex to do what it needs to do. We, you know, we just don't know. And that's part of, you know, my research question. There's a lot of great groups who are working on this, trying to figure out this, you know, this fundamental neuroscience question.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I had an MRI of my brain recently over the summer and the report said, use the word unremarkable.
Oh, no.
Well, better that than no fold.
Yeah. I didn't even mention any faults. I don't know. I don't know. That was going to be my next question, Michaela. Do you, like, in terms of imaging and so forth, I mean, obviously there's so many different animals that are interesting in this space and where they fold. You know, is there sort of a new imaging world that gives you a lot of insights? You know, like, can you do this sort of stuff in a, you know, functional MRI and look at what folding is happening and you know over time, like what sort of capabilities have we got now?
We have actually done some MRI in our lab. We just had a publication recently looking at a layer of the brain called the subplate. And so we did some MRI in the ferrets. We've also done it in sheep as well. We were trying to look for changes in the way that the water signals, which is what the MRI is picking up, the movement of water molecules in the brain, might help us predict where a fold and form is going to change because we get a different signal in different parts of the brain that we wouldn't otherwise be able to see.
Right.
So we were using that in the ferret, but At the moment, it's just very hard to correlate. You know, it's just kind of one extra step beyond, you know. So we've got the clues, but we just have to work that much harder to try and put it all together, this big, you know, folded brain puzzle that we have.
That's cool stuff. And before we let you go, I know in the information you sent to me, you're a pretty big advocate for especially young women considering STEM. Did you want to send a message out to all the aspiring young, you know, women who might want to get into brain folding research?
I would love to. I'd love to. I don't know how many young female listeners you have, but, and, you know, anyone who's listening who's considering a career in science or thinking about getting into a career in science, please do. The research is incredibly rewarding. You know, you really get to put your heart and soul into it, and it's incredibly worth it. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to work in a lab with some very wonderful, smart, beautiful women that, you know, really uplift you and support. You know, the environment's amazing. So it's definitely worth getting into. And, yeah, hopefully I can recruit a few people.
Sounds good. Well, we certainly try and do that here. So
yes.
We've been there. On it.
Yeah. And, you know, people say,
come to the dark side.
Not sure how many women are listening. I'm like, I don't know, seven?
All seven of you better come to the dark side.
Come to the dark side. We have ferrets.
Ferrets are cool. Ferrets are cool. But I think it's the, you know, it's the decade or a couple of decades of the brain with all the imaging capabilities and things that we're now learning. It's just a fascinating time. You know, we were just talking to, you know, astrophysics sort of areas are the same. It's just such a great time to be in these fields.
It's an exciting time.
And we're understanding more and more about the brain that we never knew before, especially from an immunotherapy perspective and all sorts of things. It's amazing. So, but yeah, brain folding is cool. Mikhail, thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us today.
Thank you for having me. I had a blast.
Awesome. We are going to take a break for some station announcements, folks. And then when we come back, we're talking about, dinosaurs. Awesome stuff.
Hooray.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's good stuff.
Coming up at the Corner Hotel, Jade LeMack, Vola, Noasis, Hothouse Flowers and Steve W. Punk Rave Party. Also in the calendar, Lambrini Girls, Maverick Sabre, the Bel Air Lip Bombs, Stella Donnelly and the Reserve Drivers Live Podcast. Plus Riot Fest, DJ Boner Boy, Melbourne Death Fest, Elephant Sessions, Milk Orange, Blanco White, Grace Petrie and June Rats. Visit cornerhotel.com, RRR sponsors.
From director Bradley Cooper comes Is This Thing On?, an intimate, funny and honest look at marriage and identity starring Will Arnett and Laura Dern. Alex Novak is a midlife father on the cusp of divorce, but when he applies to perform stand-up at a local comedy club, he finds a new release that reinvigorates his life. Is This Thing On? Is now showing at Cinema Nova Carlton, RRR sponsors.
For educators, parents and curious minds, if you want lessons kids actually lean into, cool.org is the place to go. Free curriculum-aligned grab-and-go resources for early learning through to Year 10, covering climate science, social justice, digital smarts and heaps of resources honouring First Nations knowledges, all proven to engage young minds. There's also on-demand professional learning for educators. cool.org. Practical, hopeful, change-making. A proud NAM-based charity and RRR sponsor.
RRR presents Clunes Booktown Festival, celebrating its 20th anniversary with a wonderful weekend of books and festivities, March 21 and 22. Dive into a stellar program on the theme of defiance and hope with Bob Brown, Tony Jordan, Dennis Altman, Sophie Laguna, Maxime Benaber-Clark, RRR's Mel Fulton and more, featuring authors' talks, over 130 book traders, a kids' village, entertainment and a night sky dreaming event. Learn more at clunesbooktown.org.au. Proud RRR sponsors.
Welcome back, folks. There's about 15 minutes left on Einstein and Gogo. In the studio now, we have Dr. Jake Kotevsky from Monash University. Jake is part of the School of Biological Sciences. Jake, welcome to RRR.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I saw your stuff coming out this week because, you know, whenever I see stuff about dinosaurs, I get excited and I send emails. And yes, luckily, you're available this weekend. But give us a bit of a rundown on the sort of stuff you do, because you also work with Museums Victoria, which has got people forget just how much stuff is stored at the museum that's not on display, right?
That's right. There's so much actually behind the scenes that you don't get to see. And particularly in Australia, it's a lot of the Australian fossil stuff is behind the scenes. Melbourne Museum, I guess the kind of big things you see are Triceratops, which is not an Australian dinosaur. And there are Australian dinosaurs on display as part of the geologic history of Victoria, but majority of our stuff is actually in the collections that most people don't get to see or don't even know of in their lifetime. So there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than people know.
Is there, I want to kind of image a, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of cavernous structure underneath the museum where it's all stored. Is
wooden crates.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know where you're at.
Is that what we're
no
talking
longer
about?
Wooden crates. No, it's nice shelving and it's well kept, nice climate controlled,
right.
But it kind of feels like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I love that. It's fantastic. How do you go about sort of accessing those samples? I mean, talk us through what that looks like. Do you just go down and say, crate number 412, I wouldn't mind having a look at that. It looks like a toe bone. You know, it's like, what does that look like?
It's sort of like that. The Melbourne Museum collection is really well digitized.
Yep.
So you can kind of, everything has a code, everything has a barcode. You can access what shelf it's in, what cabinet it's in. And then you just got to find the number.
Okay.
And if you kind of know what you're looking for, it's a bit easier. Sometimes when you do your PhD, you can get a student drawer, so you can move things out to the temporary student drawer, so you have easier access to it. But it's pretty much just putting in access requests and just being granted and being able to look at something.
And is it a kind of white glove, mask up kind of scenario for looking at these samples, or how does that all work?
Not really. I mean, you can kind of do it just as you are, don't really need the lab coats or anything, but as long as you're careful, we usually use like soft padded surfaces underneath just in case people drop it.
Yeah, yeah.
These things happen. So many fossils break. Thankfully, you can glue fossils back together.
That only touches
the nice stuff until you've broken something that's not important.
It's a very Kintsugi method.
I love that.
Of going for it.
Jake, you say that like from experience.
I have broken a few bones in my... Thankfully, it was just an emu bone. When I first volunteered at the museum, I was preparing a limb bone. It was either kangaroo or emu. I accidentally snapped it in half. And I was told, oh, well, it's hollow. We know it's an emu now. So we found out.
Did you make a wish?
Very good.
So they tend to trust you more when you've shown that you're a bit careful and you don't break things. But it sometimes just happens. Things are just so fragile and thin that they're inevitably going to break.
Yeah, of course. When you think about your sort of time in a given year, like how much of your time is spent looking at that collection versus looking for new fossils in the field?
It's most of the time in the collection. We have a massive backlog. A lot of it is fragments and shards that don't really tell you anything, but they're important to catalogue. Sometimes there are important historical finds. I wish there was more time in the field. I probably got to spend 2 to 3 weeks maximum in the field during my PhD. Some of the things we find, by the time they're prepared, it's going to take years, so I might not even get to look at them. I've gone on digs where we've pulled stuff out, and it's still just kind of waiting.
Right.
So not entirely sure. But I've been through every process. I've collected in the field. I've identified in the field. I've prepared stuff at museums. I've observed things at museums, and I've published on them. So
interesting.
I try to be part of the whole process.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a very practical question about this. Being, you know, part of a synchrotron beamline team before my current job, I know that a lot of fragments from fossil finds get scanned, you know, like in 3D. How many of them do you actually like scan and categorize like that? Because, you know, often you do that and you do carbon dating or something to actually know how old they are and what they are, and I get like a full 3D imagery of that, of if it's a CT or x-ray. How many of them do you do that on, or is it like just if it's in the same area we assume it's just the same age kind of scenario?
Yeah, well, mainly with the synchrotron stuff, we're kind of looking at internal data. So they usually reserve it for skull material. So you can see like suturing and fusion between the bones as things age, or also internal things. Something I've worked on, Australovenator, it's a predatory dinosaur from Queensland. And previously at the synchrotron, they've stuck the lower jaw, the dentary, through it. And in the data, you can see replacement teeth ready to come out, which you couldn't see just based on the fossils. So the synchrotron is actually really valuable, and we have really good connections with them, particularly in Aussie Paleo. They're just opening up a new field of being able to ID these things. So the really special stuff gets to go there.
It's cool stuff. Jake, tell us about the sort of Australian landscape in terms of the dinosaurs that we've had. I mean, I know, you know, with especially with Northern Hemisphere dinosaurs, they've got better marketing teams, to be fair, except for the Brontosaurus, which has taken a bit of a hit lately. But, you know,
it's back.
I mean, obviously it wasn't paying its dues to the dinosaur mafia, and it got done over by the Apatosaurus, I think, as I recall.
I think it got rolled into it.
Yeah, and now it's its own thing again. And now it's back. It's paid its dues. It's back. But, you know, like, obviously our dinosaurs don't have the marketing grunt of some of the European options and the North American options. But how do ours stack up? I mean, do we have the big stuff, the interesting stuff, the predators, the, like...
Well, that's where it gets interesting. So we've only really been collecting proper in the last 40 years.
Right.
I mean, we're playing catch-up with a lot of the rest of the world. Europe and the States, they've been collecting since the 1800s, maybe late 1700s. They have a lot of time and a lot of really good material.
Yep.
And that's because a lot of their dinosaur age rock is exposed where they can actually collect things. We're on a geologically, I guess, stable continent. We don't have that much uplift and movement. Yep. It's kind of just mainly erosion. So we're limited to what's exposed. That's what's always going to be exposed. And with the dinosaurs, we don't get that many glimpses. The first dinosaur bone in Australia was found in 1906 on the Bass Coast.
Yesterday.
Just yesterday. But then there was kind of a hiatus until the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
That's when they started to find a lot of the dinosaurs in Victoria down on the Otway and Bass Coast. The dinosaurs of darkness, if you watched National Geographic and Walking with Dinosaurs back in the 90s. And then some stuff in Queensland too. I guess probably the most famous Australian dinosaur, Muttaburrasaurus, big herbivorous dinosaur. There's one at every museum. There's a replica. But we're really, in the last, I guess, 30, 40 years, really starting to ramp up things. We're finding a lot of fragments in Victoria that are identifying what we have here. And particularly in that same time period, dinosaurs in South America are becoming better known. They get better fossils than we do, largely. And our material is really similar to theirs because they were, I guess, they were distributing between or through Antarctica between the two continents. So they have the same kind of dinosaurs. So we're seeing complete things from them, being able to ID what our fragmentary ones are. And then we also have places like Winton in central Queensland, which is now becoming the dinosaur capital of Australia. Right. We're finding really nice, complete dinosaurs.
Interesting.
For Australia. Yeah. You know, things that are still about 20 to 30% complete, but that's better than one bone.
Yeah, because when I think about, you know, you look around the world and there's always that predator and non-predatory dinosaur pair, you know, so there's the T-Rex and the Brontosaurus, the Gigantosaurus, I think it is in South America, and I can't remember what the other side of that one is. But there's always those pairs.
Yep.
I mean, I'm curious as to what we have or whether we'll find that like in Antarctica or other southern location sites, which are bloody hard to look
at. Well, that's something I'm trying to figure out as well. We're kind of weird. We don't have a large predator. Our largest ones are a group called the Megaraptorids. I'll just call them Megaraptors because it's easier.
Yep.
But these are animals about 5 to 7 meters in length.
Yep.
It's a big animal, but it's not a 13-meter T-Rex. We found them alongside small herbivorous ornithopods, they're called, little bipedal herbivore dinosaurs in Victoria. But in Queensland, they've been found alongside sauropods, your big long necks. Comparative, let's say Australovenator is about a 300 to 400-kilo animal, and the sauropods it's with it can get to 21 ton.
Wow.
I don't think it's hunting that. Might be scavenging it. But we either don't have a large predator, or we just haven't found one.
It yet.
Maybe that pairing's not there. I'm starting to think that maybe our Megaraptors like to target the small bipedal herbivores because in every place we find a Megaraptor, Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland, you find those small, we call them elasmarians, ornithopods. Maybe they're targeting those. But it's, you know, it's not a big story like T-Rex, Triceratops, Giganotosaurus, and a sauropod. You know,
but fascinating.
We're trying to figure it out.
I mean, I like to think if we've got, you know, we had wombats the size of Volkswagens, we're going to have a big one.
You'd hope so. I think there's one. I think there's one waiting to be found.
Yeah.
I mean, we're very new to the dinosaur game. Yeah. And there's so much, particularly in Queensland, so much to be explored and so much to be found. Even in Victoria, we're finding new sites now. Like, you might have seen in the last week, our annual volunteer dig's going on, and they've pulled out some new stuff from the site that we're targeting at the minute, and we're finding lots there. We found plenty of turtles and dinosaurs and other herbivorous dinosaurs, some fish stuff. Looking for mammals as well, that's part of what we're looking at there, small, tiny mammal jaws. So we're starting to really understand the diversity of what life was like back then in Australia.
Yeah. Before we let you go, what's the situation down in Antarctica? Because we don't talk about Antarctic dinosaurs very often.
There are some. It's quite difficult, you know, to get to Antarctica in general, let alone conduct paleontology there.
Yep.
But they have a group of ankylosaurs, your small armored dinosaurs. We call them the para-ankylosaurs.
I love the ankylosaurs. Mm. They're great. They're wicked.
They're awesome. In 2021, a new one was found from Chile called Stegurus, and it has this tail that kind of looks like one of those Mayan war clubs with the spikes.
The whacking tail. Yeah, I love that.
It is related to Antarctopelta from Antarctica.
Right.
Also has those tail bits. And then one from Queensland called Kumbarosaurus. That doesn't have the tail, but the rest of the body looks similar. So we know that those dinosaurs are kind of in all three continents. We're also seeing it with a group of raptors called the Unalajines. They're in all three continents. And these elasmerians, these ornithopods. I'd expect a megaraptor to be there because that's how they're getting through both continents.
Yep.
It's through Antarctica. Maybe sauropods, if they like the climate or not, or the high latitudes. Hard to say, but... It's kind of a missing piece of the story, Antarctica, because it's so hard to collect.
Yep.
But there's some important stuff there that'll inevitably contribute to the Australian story.
Yeah, look, I think it's fascinating. Jake, I've got another 274 questions, so we'll probably have to get you back because I think the dinosaur space in Australia, I always wonder whether there's going to be like just herds, if I can use that term for paleontologists, herds of paleontologists from the Northern Hemisphere saying, look, we've done all this shit here. Let's go and scope out the Southern Hemisphere because there's so much.
There is, but there's also so many different things you can do. Like I do your basic descriptions and comparisons. I look at a bone, I describe what it looks like, I figure out what animal it belongs to, and then sometimes I do family trees, phylogenetics, try and figure out what they're related to. You can do things like biomechanics, skeletal reconstructions, muscle reconstructions, range of movement, bite force. There's so many things you can explore. Yeah. There's so many avenues, and because the Northern Hemisphere dinosaurs are so well understood, those are those avenues they can start to target.
Right.
Again, we're on the back foot. We're trying to figure out what our animals look like before we can think about those things.
That's cool stuff. Well, Jake, thanks so much for coming in today, and we'll get you back to talk more about dinosaurs. And I do want to hear more about the Ray's Lost Ark Cavern underneath the museum, because I think that is wild stuff. And I know we used to talk years ago about their rock collection, and I know there's a big display now at Melbourne Museum. It used to be a single shop front, and to bring some of that out for the public was amazing. But, it costs money. So, good work, and keep digging.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, that was Dr. Jake Kotevsky. Did I get that right, Jake?
Kotevsky.
Yeah, I thought I got pretty it right close. The first time. Yeah, I don't know.
You got it right the first time.
Got it right the first
time. It's the end of the show.
End of the show. I'm out of juice. That's what happens. Dr. Susie, good to see you.
Yeah, that was great.
It's been a while.
I love talking about dinosaurs at the end of a show. It's nice.
I love talking about science. Chris KP. Good to see you.
Likewise, and it's great to have to share a microphone so I have an excuse to headbutt Susie.
I know.
You two have behaved relatively well today, I have to say, which is not for listeners out there. It's not a given.
Cut it out before the show.
Sorry, it won't happen again.
It takes a lot. I always am afraid that the microphones are accidentally on during the music breaks because you just never know what comes out of these two. But it can be problematic. We are going to hand over in just a minute to the team from Eat It. A huge thank you to our guests today. We actually, we covered off three major universities today. We had University of Melbourne, we had Monash University, and we had, Museums of Victoria as well, and we also had RMIT. So that's a pretty good cross-section of the fact that Victoria has an amazing group of researchers from across many institutions and universities. So it's a pretty good place to be.
Now go fund them.
Yeah, go find them.
Pay me to look at dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Please.
Just drop a big briefcase of cash off at Jake's front door and you'll go and look at dinosaurs all day long. Thanks so much for listening to Einstein the Go-Go. I'm Dr. Shane. Remember, science is everywhere. Have a wonderful Sunday and we will chat to you again next week.
Radio. Sorry. Subscriber Radio. RRR FM. Is that it? Shall we do more? 102.7. No, that's it for the moment.
Hey, guys. Why don't we eat?
Dear, don't cause a fuss. I'll have your spam. I love it. I'm in spam, spam, spam.
Cornflakes. 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 Cornflakes.
Anyone fancy a pint?
Suit you, sir.
Spam, 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 baked beans, spam, 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 and spam.
I said I don't want any damn vegetables.
Lentils are really good, you know?
Forbidden donut.